We gather to seek, to find, and to share the promise of honest religion. And so it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this.
A place for questions more profound than answers.
Vulnerability more powerful than strength.
And a peace that can pass all understanding.
It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Please join me in a spirit of prayer. We give thanks for life and truth and are grateful when they find us. The kind of light that can heal comes in so many forms, from so many directions. It may be that the best way to live is with the kind of openness and trust that seems so much easier for children than for adults. When the man Jesus pointed to small children and said we must be like them if we are to enter the kingdom of God, it was a profound truth that transcended even him and was rooted in the deep nature of life itself. Let us not think that religion is about swooning to the sound of heavenly words or even heavenly music. It's about coming alive in the best way. It's living fully and well that generates the heavenly music, not the other way around. Let us give thanks when we are found by the kind of truth that can set us free and make us feel more whole. And let us try to be vehicles of that kind of truth and healing for the parts of our world nearest our hearts. Those in our larger world need us just as we need them, for we really are all in this together. And for that, too, we give thanks. Amen. Covenant is a weird word. In 22 years, I've never preached on it, seldom use it, and always get suspicious of people who throw it around like it's a something of which all really cool people should have one. So after deciding to bring it to you as a Sunday theme, I had to try and understand it well enough to know why I think it's worth your time to hear about it in a sermon. For me, that meant trying to learn a wide variety of covenants, both from religion and from real life, because I think the more ways we can say something, the better the chances are that we actually know what we're trying to talk about. So let me start with you, the way I started with myself, by talking about a lot of different kinds of covenants, so that the pattern and the meaning of what this thing is about might come alive from several different directions. It's actually about something pretty important. One of the classic statements is from the Bible, from the book of Joshua, where the writer goes on about how you don't have to like his gods, he doesn't care, you can serve whatever gods you like. But then he ends with the famous line, "But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Really wonderful poetry. Just another is the famous statement of Martin Luther when he decided he had to serve a different definition, a different style of God than the Roman Catholic Church had served for almost 1,500 years. And he said, "Here I stand, I can do no other. God help me. Amen." Now, as I said last week, this wasn't long before he had to hide out for about a year and a half, because the church was trying to have him killed for this. But he was sustained in his hiding out by the new faith to which he had given himself, And I think probably the most detailed and the most demanding example of a religious covenant is in the religion of Islam. We are in their high holy month, this month, the month of Ramadan, when Muslims are expected to fast during the day for a whole month as an exercise in spiritual purification. But fasting is only one of the five pillars of Islam, as they say. There are four other things required of all Muslims, whether Shiite or Sunni. They're required to profess their faith out loud in words. They're required to do the ritual prayers five times a day. They're required to pay a percentage of their income each year to benefit the poor. And the poor may make a claim on their income. I don't know another religion with that element to it. And at some time in their life, they're required to make a pilgrimage to Mecca. Now, these are all pretty dramatic. But the idea of becoming possessed by an idea or a cause that gives you life is not just something that happens in organized religions. It happens all over the place. And part of what I want to do is make the concept so familiar to you that you realize the places that it's happened in your life already. One very local, very down-to-earth example of it, for me, I'm a member of a local group of former military officers. It was started by a retired Air Force general that I know here in town, and most of the officers in it were colonels or generals. I'm the token former lieutenant and also the token minister in the group. What I like most about this group is the deep and powerful covenant these men made with the oath they took as officers when they were on active duty, and how much that oath still empowers them. For the past few years, this is a pretty uppity group of former generals and colonels, for the past few years they have been mailing letters to the highest level of military commanders, four-star generals mostly, some of whom they know personally, reminding them of the oath that they took as officers and reminding them that this oath was to uphold the Constitution, not to support a president who has violated his office by invading Iraq and by systematically destroying the freedoms and civil liberties at home that these soldiers had once believed they had sworn an oath to uphold. "We have a sacred duty to uphold the Constitution," they will say. "And we have all devoted our lives to that duty." That kind of statement moves me very deeply. That's a covenant. It's a very powerful one. And at one time or other, most of these men have risked their lives on behalf of their belief in that. It doesn't have to be that dramatic. It can be very, very tame and down to earth and mundane. These three banners hanging up front are inviting a kind of covenant. It's the covenant of people in every religion I know of. There isn't anything very special about it. I can't think of a religion anywhere on earth whose people don't believe that they are there to seek the kind of truth that can set them free, though what those truths are will differ for them, to help them come more alive, and to help them heal themselves, their relationships, and the parts of the world that touch them. It's very close to the definition of what it means to be religious or just to be serious about life. This transcends religion. And taking it seriously, giving ourselves to it, is a covenant that can be as binding as a general's oath to uphold the Constitution or Martin Luther saying, "Here I stand, I can do no other." The banners and lights are reminders. The banners point to the lights because those ideals can each open us to the kinds of light we need. The lights point to the banners because we need to be lit up by plugging into only the highest ideals and letting them take possession of us like the angels of our better nature. The story of Androcles and the lion is a story about an implicit covenant. I had never thought about it that way until I started working on this sermon. He comes from Aesop's fables. Aesop lived about 2,500 years ago, the same time the Buddha was living. Androcles' covenant was with life, not the lion. The lion was just the form of life that happened to be around and needed his help. Could just as easily have been a dog or a cat or a child, and I'm sure at the time Androcles would have preferred that. But he had a covenant with life. He was part of life and recognized the lion as part of life and reached out to help it. That's a covenant. The lion's covenant was much simpler. It was just with Androcles, no other humans, the man who had saved his life. In the statement I read last week, a 10-word statement from the Christian scriptures, it's a statement of the spirit of liberal religion from the Bible that's about as succinct as anything I've ever read. It's also inviting you into a covenant. You remember the words were, examine everything carefully, hold fast to what is good. That's a statement that transcends religion. It's a statement of the scientific method. It's a statement of any approach to honesty that says nothing can stand in the way of the search for it, and when we find it, we'll cling to it. When I was in graduate school, I went to a graduate school with a reputation for badgering anyone who claimed to know a fact. And it was true, and I liked that about it. And I remember the first few times I heard it, how shocking it was to hear anyone say something is true and then immediately be asked the questions that I came to learn and came to ask afterward, that no matter what the claim is, the first question is, what was your methodology for arriving at that? What method did you use? Was it psychological? If so, what kind of psychology? Freudian? Jungian? Adlerian? What was your method? What do you do with people who also use that method and who use the same data but who've reached different conclusions from you? What do you do with that? What do you do with people who use different methods, who think that different data are more important in considering the issue and reach different conclusions? What do you do with them? That's what I mean by badgering. And by the time they get through, what you're left saying, which is about the only true thing any of us can say, so there's marvelous humility built into it. About the only thing left for you to say is, all right, if you look at the same data that I did, and you think about it in the same way that I did, I can probably get you to agree with me. That's about as far as we can go, but there's a humility in it that is so life-giving and so refreshing because it leaves room always for the discussion to go on and for anyone else to enter into the discussion. That's a covenant that gives life in its own way. Now, I don't want to push the metaphors too far on this, but I'll do only one more metaphor. If life were an automobile, you can tell I'm pushing this. If life were an automobile, the covenant would be the transmission. That's how we get the power transferred to us. That's how we assimilate and incarnate the promised power of religion or of any life-giving beliefs. Every commitment with consequences comes from a covenant, whether we're aware of it or not. Not all covenants are good. Not all gods are good. Not all gods give life. Some drain it away from you in the name of lower and more selfish things that they're serving. After all, mafia members also have a covenant. So do those conspiring to commit a crime have a covenant. Corporations or military organizations that punish whistleblowers are really saying that the whistleblowers violated an implied covenant to put the corporation's interests above all other considerations, including truth, safety, and justice. Not all covenants are good. But one of the most hopeful facts of life is that most of us can tell the difference between coming alive and selling out. and we can tell it at a very early age. That's what's so hopeful. I've been reading for some of my summer reading and escapism. I read two sets of I'm not sure what the genre is called, two sets of teen fantasy series books. One was a four-volume set by Rick Riordan on Percy Jackson and the Olympians. And it's a retelling of the Greek myths, and a wonderful, very imaginative retelling of the Greek myths. The children in this book, in this series, are called half-bloods, meaning that they're really half-human, but they're also the sons and daughters of particular Greek gods or goddesses. And so they have the nature of their divine parents deep and powerfully within them. And they have to learn how to serve that nature, because, of course, their job is to save the world. Well, you can see why kids would love this. They're just lovely stories and wonderfully written. I know that you're getting what this is about. It's really about a fundamental concept in religion and in life. It's the question of what are we serving, and is it giving us the kind of life that we want? Is it making us a blessing to ourselves and to others? Does it make us feel beloved of this place? Otherwise, it's not worth serving. Now, here's one more example that may not sound at all like a covenant. It's one I first heard over 40 years, so I've thought about it a long time. My undergraduate degree was in music theory from the University of Michigan. When I first came here in 2000 and football season was on and people were going crazy, someone in the church asked me just before I came into the sanctuary some Sunday how I was adjusting to living in a town with a really good football spirit. So I said in the sermon that I told that story, and then I said, you know, I came from the University of Michigan where they had a really big football stadium. No one laughed. So I've never said that again. While I was at Michigan in the music school, I still remember a remark from a lecture on composition and orchestration about the French impressionist composer Maurice Ravel. He's the guy who wrote Bolero, but he also wrote a lot of much more complex, wonderful stuff. And he was regarded as perhaps the greatest orchestrator of the 20th century. The line that stayed with me came when the professor said that the most remarkable thing about Ravel was that he never published a bad piece of music. He wrote some, of course. Even the best of composers wrote some bad music. But he destroyed it before he died. He burned it. No one ever heard it. We have no idea what his fairly good music sounded like. And we have no idea what his bad music sounded like. He never published a bad piece of music. It violated something in him that felt that he was commanded to serve the muses only at the highest possible level that he could serve them, nothing less. That's a covenant. That's powerful stuff. As I've reflected on that over the years, I've thought this really makes Ravel a lot like a saint. One of those people way more perfect than we would ever aspire to be. We don't hear stories about saints being really nasty or rude or cruel or selling out to a lobbyist. I don't know how they were in real life. We may never know that. But the image created of them by those who wrote and told and have protected their stories is the image of someone who lived a nearly perfect life, who never published a bad action. That's how Ravel was like a saint, living the life of a composer who never published a bad piece of music, no matter how much the market demanded that he do so. And you know it demanded that he did so. It's astonishing to me. It's inspiring. When you come here on Sunday, and if you've come here a while, you already know this, but it's still worth saying out loud once in a while. You know that that Brian Ferguson, our ministerial intern, that all of our paid and unpaid musicians, our lay leaders, our greeters and ushers, you know that we will be trying to serve the highest ideals we can. That's what this room is for. That's what makes it sacred space. It lays a command on us when we enter it and when we come up on this stage. We may fail at it, but that's what we're trying to do every single week. We have made a covenant with high religious ideals, high musical ideals, a covenant to serve the kinds of truths that can make us more whole and help us come more alive and help us heal ourselves and those others in our world whose lives we can touch. That's as sacred as it gets. And that's what we're here to do every week. And you know that if you've been coming here for a while. Every week you know this is a room where you can come to hear inspiring and challenging words and music. If it's more challenging than inspiring, it may not always be comfortable. The musical piece the choir did today is a great example of that in music. This was Bobby McFerrin's setting of the 23rd Psalm, where if you could hear the words, God is referred to through feminine pronouns. Now, that may not be very shocking here, but our choir sang that piece several years ago for the annual meeting of the North Central Caregivers, hosted at a Missouri Synod Lutheran church. And I got a very angry voicemail left on my phone by the minister of that church about how rude it was to bring a choir in singing something that blasphemous in their church. So it may not always be comfortable, but it will always be inspiring and challenging, I hope. And you'll hear talk about that rather than talk about outsourcing, downsizing, maximizing profit for stockholders, winning through intimidation, or learning how to swim with the sharks, as though that wouldn't just turn us into more sharks while outsourcing our souls. This church, like all sanctuaries, is committed to being a nourishing place to dream of making better music with our lives and protecting the dreamers while we dream. It's a place, and these worship services are homes where we can dream in peace together, dreams of finding and being converted by the kinds of truths that can help us become more free and whole, that can help us become filled to overflowing with life so that the world around us might be nourished by the overflow. And God knows it needs it. The goal of all this seems to be able to live as Ravel did his music, only publishing the best. To the extent that we could pull that off, it would be pretty admirable. What if that children's author, Rick Riordan, and the composer Ravel are right? What if we really are all half divine, called to find that higher voice, those angels of our better nature, the healing kind of harmony, let it get inside of our souls and shape us in its image? What if all the works we published in our lives had the mark of that kind of an excellent spirit? We'd be eligible for sainthood, for one thing. But here's another way of putting this. You're going through your life, wandering around a bit. You see this church and you think, oh no, that's religion, and I don't trust it. It isn't honest. I know religion, and I know truth, and never the twain shall meet. And you come in and you hang around a bit and you think, Oh, well, all right, I get this. I see, it's just ideas. It's just abstract ideals and values and talk like that. It's kind of like reading philosophy books. That wasn't so hard. Well, that's kind of interesting. All right, ho-hum. And then one day, you become aware that a large sort of animal near you is suffering. It's a thorn of some kind, stuck in it, a big painful thing. The animal needs your help. You've learned about suffering and truth. You know those ideas. And you know that even you can help alleviate suffering. It's a little scary, but you find some courage. Maybe the courage comes from realizing that after all, you are half divine. And you call on the power and the courage of that god or goddess who's always been with you as part of your soul. So you do it. In spite of some fear, you pull out the thorn from this animal's foot. You do it perhaps not because you cared so much for this one suffering animal, but you've learned to care for life. And this potentially powerful creature is very much alive. So you heal it. It's only afterwards, when you begin to notice how much more easily and lightly you are walking, that you realize that the animal all along was really you. And this little life-changing drama also has a soundtrack. It's accompanied by a choir of the better angels of our nature singing some of the most beautiful music ever published.